The Inter-American University of the Air presents Chapter 9 of Lands of the Free, a story of Canada, titled The Road to Dominion. This is Canada speaking. For tonight's program comes to you from Canada and is produced by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation as its contribution to the Inter-American University of the Air. Our story tells of her progress in self-government and her development as a nation member of the British Commonwealth. The Road to Dominion. This is the story of Canada's road to dominion. To dominion from sea to sea. A road born in war, but built toward lasting peace. It is a story of fierce loyalty and unyielding independence, of selfishness and unselfishness, a prophetic vision and incredible blindness, of hot-headed rebellion leading to constitutional triumph. It is indeed a story of constitutional revolution.
Beginning of the road, 1776.
The road was to bear heavy traffic. Its foundations were laid in loyalty. In the 13 American colonies, there were thousands whose loyalty to the mother country was unshakable. Their loyalty was nothing passive, but something active which had to be practiced, and practice it they would. In the new United States, there was no room for them. Therefore, they would find room. They, in turn, would seek their freedom. They would march.
And march they did, up to the wilds of Canada. That was the province of Canada, mostly French, stretching from Labrador on the east to the Mississippi and Ohio rivers on the south and west.
The passing years saw the taming of the wilderness by these sturdy and vigorous loyalist pioneers. And in little more than 10 years since the American Declaration of Independence, the governor of Canada, Lord Dorchester, found it necessary to sail for England to confer with Mr. Pitt, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. The conference became an argument.
You're refusing to see the point.
But my dear Lord Dorchester, what I don't understand is the reason for your request. You come to me and you say you want a bill to be passed to divide Canada into two. Why? What's behind your request? What's the matter with the colonies?
Nothing's the matter with them.
Then what do they want?
The right to run their own affairs.
But that's independence, Dorchester. Do they want to tear themselves away from the protection of the mother country?
No, Mr. Pitt. That's not their desire at all. They simply feel that they hewed a new British colony out of a wilderness, and they want to run it their own way. And I must say, I sympathize
you
with them.
You sympathize with them? I thought you were the governor of Canada, not one of its dissatisfied
citizens. Mr. Pitt, you must understand that these British settlers are among the most loyal subjects His Majesty has. The fact that they came to Canada at all proves that. But they are in no way akin to the French settlers. Everything about them is different, and the form of government that suits the French is unpalatable to
now,
the British.
Surely
that Dorchester. Is the truth, Mr. Pitt. The French habitants are a passive people, content to live on the land, cultivate it and worship it in their own way. Mm-hmm. They are active only when it comes to preserving the characteristics of their nationality. The loyalist settlers, on the other hand, are active in every way, in their loyalty to the crown, their determination to move from a place where they were not wanted, and, if I may so put it, their insistence on being loyal in their own independent fashion.
Independent loyalty? Nonsense. There isn't such a thing.
And I say there is, Mr. Pitt. I've seen it at work. The loyalty of colonists who have come of age, so to speak, and who live as free men, is the soundest type of loyalty the Crown can be offered. His Majesty's government would do well to encourage it. You must see, Mr. Pitt, and all the leaders after you, that the loyalty freely given by self-governing colonies will be the foundation upon which the British Empire will stand firm. By passing the bill to divide Canada into two, you will make the first step towards responsible government in His Majesty's possessions. Side by side, the British and French Canadians may march together. Under one rule, they might march against one another. Let us be wise before the event.
The result of wisdom was the Constitutional Act, 1791. The first step on the road to dominion.
The road was commenced in war. In war came its first proving.
The test came in 1812. War arose between the United States and Canada. Would the two Canadian races march side by side? Would they recognize a common future and fight for it?
The first victory, Michilimackinac, won by French and English troops under Roberts and Fortier. They fought side by side.
The victory of Chateauguay, won by the French de la Salaberry with his voltigeur.
Throughout the campaign, French and English Canadians fought side by side. The road to dominion had reached its first great milestone. It marked the first time that French and English fought together as Canadians against a common foe.
The War of 1812 had the obvious result. The colonists had fought and bled for a stretch of land where they lived. How else then could they regard that land but as their country?
Their new feelings of nationalism brought new troubles. Of quarrels, there were dozens. Of grievances, there were hundreds.
The French in Lower Canada felt that they had not equal representation with the British population. In Upper Canada, the newer colonists found dissatisfaction against the older loyalists. Talk was everywhere violent.
Family compact, indeed. Just because they're allowed to call themselves United Empire Loyalists, just because they came here before the rest of us, they think they own the place.
I tell you, something's got to be done about it. I came up here from the States to settle down and become a loyal Canadian. I know what really sent me up here was because conditions are bad just now down there. But the reason I came up doesn't count. What counts is the kind of colonist I'm trying to be. I'm loyal to the king. I undertook that when I came over the border. But what happens? These people and their family compact. They set themselves up like an aristocracy here.
Aye.
They're the only ones to have a say in how the province is to be run.
Aye, they and the governor and the council. They control the council, and the governor's always a friend of theirs. I tell you, something's got to be done.
Yeah, it's all very well, but what?
We'll fight.
Fight? Another revolution?
Oh, no, not that kind of a fight. No bloodshed. We've got to fight constitutionally. We've got to organize ourselves into a party and be elected by the assembly. We've got to gain a majority in the assembly.
Gentlemen, the new leader of the Radical Party, Mr. William Lyon Mackenzie.
Gentlemen, I thank you for your hearty support and for my election as the head of the Radical Party. As your leader, gentlemen, I intend to lead. Although I have long criticized the government in my paper, my decision to enter public life is but recent. My reasons for entering politics are simple. The government that is forced upon us is outrageous. And it is the duty of every one of us to work for an improvement. The government of Upper Canada is in the hands of a minority. A small group of shrewd, crafty, covetous men. They're keeping its benefits for themselves and denying them to their fellow citizens. That, gentlemen, is not loyalty to the king. That is loyalty to themselves. They're directing the wealth of this land, not to its hard-working citizens, but to their own pockets.
Well, what are we going to do about it?
We will defeat them. We will oust them. But we will do it constitutionally. We will do it through representations to His Majesty's government in England. We will remove autocracy, but we will not replace it with anarchy. We shall fight for responsible government. Government responsible to the people.
But to the English official of the day.
Unthinkable, my dear sir, unthinkable.
Is it indeed, sir? Will you pray tell me why?
Certainly. What you are asking is a system of government similar to that of Great Britain. It is no doubt the finest system in the world, but it takes the finest educated minds to administer it. And after all...
No, we're too rough. We're uneducated. Maybe we're too young.
Young, yes. Yes, the kindest way of putting it.
And I say the colonial policy of Great Britain is the policy of a doting mother. A stupid mother, too. Every mother is apprehensive of the assumption of independence and responsibility by her children. But the wise one recognizes the time when it comes. She knows they can't learn without trying. It's only the foolish mother who keeps her children too long by her side, putting off continually the day of independence. They'll never learn about the world at her apron strings.
Tut, 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 tut. Very interesting simile. But may I remind you, my young hot-headed friend, of the wise old adage, mother knows best.
Oh.
You hardly set yourselves up as an authority against the wisdom of British statesmen, surely.
I set myself up against a pack of muddle-headed fools. You're blind, sir, to progress and change. You abhor change. But I warn you that one day your blindness will lead you into trouble.
Trouble there was, and soon. There came shortly the meeting between the hot-blooded radical leaders of the two Canadas, William Lyon Mackenzie of Upper Canada and Louis-Joseph Papineau of Lower Canada. The meeting of the two hotheads could have but one result, rebellion.
July 1837, Lord Durham's house in London. Edward Wakefield and Charles Buller have just been shown into his lordship's study.
Well, Edward, we leave for Canada in 2 weeks' time.
We?
Yes, we. You and Charles and I.
I thought that because of my views on independent government for the colonies, they wouldn't let me go.
Well, not as my secretary, Edward, but I persuaded them to let me take you in an unofficial capacity.
Oh.
Now, Charles, you are to be my chief secretary.
Well, thank you, sir.
Will you come, Edward?
I most certainly will.
Good. Now, let's see exactly what we have to do. My appointment from the government makes me commissioner with very full powers to investigate the entire situation in the Canadas and discover the causes of unrest. And, of course, submit a plan to cure all the ills I may find.
It seems, sir, that even though the rebellion has failed, it may have accomplished something.
Any blow for freedom, Charles, will leave its mark, directly or indirectly. The rebel leaders in their hiding places may have the satisfaction of knowing that their revolt has at least brought about an investigation.
And by such a radical as you. Could the Prime Minister be changing the color of his coat?
Lord Melbourne's afraid of losing the Canadian colonies. He's really apprehensive, and he must take some drastic action.
Yes, against the wishes of many of his colleagues in the government, I should think.
Quite. Well, I wouldn't stand for you as my chief secretary, for instance. Never mind, you're coming with me as a private individual.
Good.
And, gentlemen, I go as governor-in-chief of Lower Canada, Upper Canada, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. I go as high commissioner to do work in the two Canadas, and I also go as governor-general of all the British possessions in North America, including Newfoundland.
Oh, good gracious, sir. Lord Melbourne must be in a state.
Lord Melbourne and his government were indeed in a state. Loss of the North American colonies would be too much for them to stomach, and in desperation they turned to the radical Durham to solve their problem. It was a master stroke, for Durham was the outstanding man available for such a task. He was honest, courageous, and a man of action, although quick-tempered and imperious. He had the greatest confidence in popular liberty and freedom, and a strong belief in the latent possibilities of the British Empire.
Durham in Canada acted with vigor, and according to his belief in the right course. He was recalled, owing to political machinations in England. But he had done his work so quickly and thoroughly that he was able to prepare his famous report, the report which became the foundation of Canadian independence. With the aid of his friends Wakefield and Buller, this cornerstone of Dominion status was written.
Now, gentlemen, it seems to me that my report must rest on two main recommendations. The first and most important is a full grant of responsible government.
No reservations, sir?
Well, a few, yes. Control of public lands, foreign relations, and so forth. But what we must emphasize is that the time has come for the Canadians to be governed on the principles which have proved so efficacious here in Great Britain.
Yeah.
They're a virile people, these colonists, and they must be left to govern themselves on a responsible basis.
Yeah.
They must elect their representatives in Parliament, and they must have the power of removing them if they fail in their responsibilities.
I agree with that, John. And I think everything else is subordinate to that main principle.
Exactly. When that's adopted, everything else will begin to fall into place.
True. Well, my second main recommendation, of course, will be that the two Canadas should be amalgamated.
Good.
Well, things have changed since the Constitutional Act of 1791.
Of course.
Seems to me that the time has come for the fostering of some national feeling in the Canadas if they're to survive. Their great democratic neighbor to the south will overshadow them and discourage them by a swift progress if they're not given some incentive to development.
And you suggest union and responsible government. Give them the form, at least, of a nation.
Exactly, that's it. As you know, I'd like to recommend a federation of all the British provinces in North America, the Maritimes and the Canadas. But the Maritimes are not ready yet to accept it. However, the union of the two Canadas will at least prepare the way for a federation. Now, I'll just read you a paragraph I've written to close our chapter on union. I'd like to hear what you think of it. By creating high prizes in a general and responsible government, we shall immediately afford the means of pacifying the turbulent ambitions and of employing in worthy and noble occupations the talents which are now only exerted to foment disorder. A general legislative union would elevate and gratify the hopes of able and aspiring men. They would no longer look with envy and wonder at the great arena of the bordering federation, but see the means of satisfying every legitimate ambition in the high offices of the judicature and executive government of their own union.
Excellent.
Splendid,
sir.
John. Splendid. I only hope that the future builders of British North America will take those sentiments for their inspiration.
Durham Report, which later became the foundation stone of Dominion status throughout the empire, was presented to Parliament on February the 11th, 1839. Just over 100 years ago, its reception testifies to the vision of its author, compared to the narrow short-sightedness of the leading journals of the day.
Said the Quarterly Review,
a trumpery report, which few will read, fewer understand, and nobody approve. Its pompous absurdities, its puerile pedantry, its distorted facts, its false reasoning, and its monstrous inconsistencies are so flagrant as hardly to require any additional exposure. If that rank and infectious report does not receive the high, marked, and energetic discountenance and indignation of the Imperial Crown and Parliament, British America is lost.
Said the London Times.
There's nothing in any of these published papers more offensive than the soft, palliative, extenuating tone adopted by Lord Durham towards the disaffected in Upper Canada, nor anything more monstrously absurd and purblind than this twaddle about making the public functionaries appointed by them under the dominion of the Empire responsible to colonial assemblies.
Thus the dignified journals of the day dismissed the report of the greatest builder among all those who labored on the road to dominion. But the genius and vision of Durham did not escape the leaders among British statesmen. And within a year, the brilliant new Governor General, Lord Sydenham, wrote,
the union is carried triumphantly through the legislatures of both provinces.
The first step in Durham's plan had been carried out, union of Upper and Lower Canada. But political strife grew worse and worse. Union was not responsible government. That was the ultimate goal, and Canadians were not to be satisfied with anything less.
1846. Lord Elgin is appointed Governor General of Canada.
Thus does the name of one more great builder of the road appear. Elgin, the son-in-law of Durham, and possessed with Durham's beliefs, worked unceasingly to bring them into being. In 1847, introduced true responsible government into Canada for the first time.
1839. The Durham Report.
1841. Union.
1847. Responsible government.
The next step.
Confederation. Oh, I hear the word on every side, David, but what exactly does it mean? How will it affect us all in Canada?
Well, it means, dear, simply the association of all the provinces under one central government.
Why do they want to do that? What will be the benefit?
Oh, first of all, my dear, the present chaotic state of affairs can't go on in the government. Here we have a French and a British province formed into a union. And a government that sits first in Montreal, then in Toronto, then in Quebec. French Canadians consider themselves most important. And the British Canadians consider themselves most important. The way things are, no ministry seems able to obtain a majority in order to carry on.
But what benefit will Confederation be?
Self-government in different parts of the country, under one central government. The central government will concern itself with the affairs of the country as a whole. But in Lower Canada, for instance, the local government will concern itself with the affairs of the French Canadians. In other words, the people of each province will be able to look after themselves.
Oh, I see. But would Confederation make us so independent that we'd no longer be under British rule?
Oh, no, no, my dear. Nothing of the sort. We want to stay under British rule, stay in the Empire, but be a self-governing nation.
A nation? Canada, a nation?
Yes, why not? Can a country of this size always remain a colony? Why, if all the provinces join together under one government, we can become one of the strongest nations in the British Empire.
I had never thought of nations in the Empire. It's a new way of thinking, really, isn't it?
No, no, not really, Mary. Durham, Sydenham, Elgin, all of those men of vision have foreshadowed it in their writings and actions. Durham showed the way to it, and now John A. Macdonald is trying to lead the country in that way.
What about Macdonald, David? Do you think he's a good man?
How like a woman. A man must be either a good one or a bad one. Well, my dear, if you want it like that, I think he's a good man. I think he's trying to lead this country in the right way. Well, there are many who question the style of his politics, his ethics. I feel Johnny Macdonald is a man with the interests of Canada at heart. He wants to raise her to the status of a nation, and more than that, he's bent on making her a nation in the British Empire. I tell you, Mary, I think he'll do it.
He did it. There were many fathers of Confederation, but the leader among them was undoubtedly Sir John A. Macdonald. In 1864, the first step came with the burial of political hatchets and an initial conference on Prince Edward Island to discuss a union of the Maritime Provinces. During the conference, delegates from the Canadas appeared and were admitted to the conference. Subsequently, all the members met in Quebec and adopted resolutions on the subject of Confederation. Then, in 1867...
Mary, it's finished.
What's finished, David? What's the matter?
Confederation, of course. Everyone has finally agreed on everything, and today we're a nation.
What does it say there in the paper?
It's over here.
Shall be called the Dominion of Canada. What's that mean?
It's the name they've chosen for us. Something new in the Empire. We're a nation now, and we have dominion from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from sea to sea. Now look what it says. It shall be called the Dominion of Canada and will consist of four provinces, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick.
So we shall be living in Ontario instead of Upper Canada. Seems funny to have only one Canada instead of Upper and Lower.
That's all there should be, one united Canada. Before very long, I think you'll see the rest of British North America all part of this Dominion.
What's the date, David?
July 1st. An easy date to remember. The day that Canada came of age.
This was the peak of achievement. The road had run a stormy course through war, rebellion, dissension, and had finally reached dominion. Canada had entered upon her journey to greatness.
1870, Manitoba formed as a province in the Dominion.
1871, British Columbia joins the Dominion.
1873, Prince Edward Island joins the Dominion.
1905, Saskatchewan and Alberta formed as provinces in the Dominion. Rapidly, Canada grew in size, strength, and prosperity. Her strength was barely guessed, for she had no occasion to demonstrate it until... war with Imperial Germany. This was the proving of the great new nation, where her young strength was brought to its first great test. Her sacrifice in young lives is a matter of record. She entered the war as a young dominion. She emerged as a proud and respected nation. Her prime minister, Sir Robert Borden, took his seat in the Imperial War Cabinet among the great Imperial leaders. On December 4th, 1918, the Canadian government expressed itself in a telegram to Sir Robert Borden in London.
In view of war efforts of dominions, other nations entitled to representation at conference should recognize unique character of British Commonwealth, composed of group of free nations under one sovereign. and that provision should be made for special representation of those nations at conference, even though it may be necessary that in any final decision reached, they should speak with one voice.
This was the last milestone but one. Authority to speak as a nation in the councils of the world and expressed in the signature of Sir Robert Borden on the peace treaty of Versailles. On to the final realization of the dream of dominion. 1931, the Statute of Westminster and the ultimate freedom. The statute says,
no act of the Parliament of the United Kingdom shall extend to a dominion as part of the law of that dominion unless it is expressly declared in that act that that dominion has requested and consented to the enactment thereof.
That is the final goal, freedom to speak for herself and act according to her own determination. No longer a colony, no longer merely part of the British Empire, but one of the free, self-governing nations of the British Commonwealth of Nations. She has earned her independence. She has fulfilled a dream. Now she is marching along the high road.
Remember what Mr. Churchill said?
Canada is the linchpin of the English-speaking world. Canada, with close relations of friendly, affectionate intimacy with the United States on the one hand, and with her unswerving fidelity to the British Commonwealth and the motherland upon the other, is the link which joins together these great branches of the human family, and is also a link which, spanning the oceans, brings the continents into their true relation, and will prevent in future generations a division growing between the proud and once happy nations of Europe and the great countries which have come into existence in the New World.
Have been listening to The Road to Dominion, the story of Canada, produced by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation as its contribution to the Inter-American University of the Air. The script was written by Alan King, freelance writer for CBC. The special music was written by Godfrey Rideout and conducted by Samuel Hersenhorn. The program was produced by Mabel Moore. Tonight's broadcast was Chapter 9 of the series Lands of the Free. This program has come to you from Toronto and was heard in Canada through the facilities of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.